health is wealth, and this is where we're going to talk about it. The Small Conversations for a Better World podcast with hosts Jillian McCormick and Susanna Steers. This podcast represents the opinions of the hosts and or their guests to the show. The content is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as medical advice nor established legal standard of care. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Small Conversations for a Better World podcast. I'm Susanna Steers.
And I'm Jillian McCormick. As a physiotherapist and a mother of children who enjoy certain contact sports, I've been introduced to the focus of today's show relatively often over the years. And I'll say that the information that I have as a clinician about how the brain moves inside of a skull and what kinds of injuries can occur to the brain of a person who might have taken a hit or fallen or been in a motor vehicle accident, well, let's just say that that information can fly in the face of being a parent meant to sign a permission slip for spring rugby. The injury that we're talking about today is that of concussion. It's called a mild traumatic brain injury, but this is a bit misleading because the reference to a traumatic brain injury makes it seem like concussion is a permanent injury to the brain. But in fact, it's not permanent. There are more differences between a traumatic brain injury and a concussion. For instance, there may not even be any other signs of trauma that we would associate with injury typically. No swelling, no bleeding, no bruising in the brain tissue itself. These things might not even be present on the surface level of someone who suffers a concussion. And on the other hand, someone who appears to have suffered a terrible hit with a bump and bruising and blood may not get a concussion from that hit. Frankly, this makes concussion a bit confusing. And then there's prevention. Make no mistake that I am a fan of preventing injury. And when it comes to concussions, though, there's a bit of a misinformation out there. So as a parent, I've been told to make sure that my kid wears his mouth guard to wrestling and to rugby. But as a clinician, I know that, in fact, no special equipment has been definitively proven to prevent concussion, not even that helmet. Now, I'm not saying a helmet doesn't prevent brain injuries, skull fractures, bruising. They absolutely do. The face shields help enormously to prevent eye damage. Even the soft ones that wrestlers use, they can help protect their ears. And it's important equipment to have. You should wear the proper equipment for the activity that you are involved in. And it definitely doesn't hurt to have that mouth guard in. I'm only saying that due to the way a brain moves inside of a skull, these things don't prevent concussion from happening, which makes it all a little more confusing. What we know is that treatment for concussion is evolving. It involves a multidisciplinary approach, meaning many different practitioners can be involved in treatment depending on where the individual with the concussion lives, so maybe what practitioners are available to them, and what symptoms that they might suffer. Concussion treatment is as evidence-based as it can be, and there may be some practitioners that you might not have thought of when considering your options for whom to call to help with your concussion. To help us best understand the mysterious injury that is concussion, with us today is the president and CEO of Neurovision, optometrist Dr. Coralie Mueller.
Dr. Mueller is an optometrist in vision development and rehabilitation. She's the founder of Neurovision Clinic, which uses neuro-optometric assessment, optometric vision therapy, and neurodevelopmental movement. She's a fellow with the College of Optometrists in Vision Development and board certified in rehabilitative optometric vision therapy. She's a clinical associate with the Optometric Extension Program Foundation, Neuro-Optometric Rehab Association, and a member of Vision Therapy Canada. Dr. Mueller completed her Doctor of Optometry with honors from the University of Waterloo in 2001. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Mueller.
Thank you.
I understand that as an undergrad, you did a double major in physiology and in psychology, which sounds like a pretty fascinating combination. Did you find that they complemented each other?
Oh, it was definitely The program fit so well with everything that was of interest to me, that I wanted to know about how the brain works along with how the body works. And beautiful thing about the double major was it allowed me to take all of the neuropsychologies, all the physiology of behavior, and also all the physiology of the senses. So that's where I first got my real initial understanding of how the vision system works in the brain, as I studied not just the vision system, but the auditory system as well, and other sensory systems, and really getting a feel for how the physiology of the brain is working in the whole psychology component of my degree. So that was remarkable. And that also, that was my through my psychology department that I was able to do a lot of vision research as well. So there were a couple of years in my university career where I was doing vision research through the psychology department.
And was there a favorite snippet of the overlap between those two things that caught you right from the start?
It was always about the interaction of how the nervous system is working throughout the whole entire body and just the whole biochemistry of what's happening in the brain and throughout just cellular biology. So the overlap between just what's going on a cellular level and just the general body itself and how that relates to how it all happens in the brain. So it was definitely just a perfect fit. It was a perfect match for what I wanted to learn and what was of keen interest to me. So I was thrilled.
That's great. Well, so why vision? I mean, it sounds like you did some research during your undergrad in the vision field. So it was obviously always of an interest, but why?
So it started back and my real interest got piqued in vision when I came to my attention that I had vision issues myself that had been undiagnosed and unrecognized. And that came to my attention when I was in first year of university. And at that point, I had ever since grade three, I had had trouble reading. So whenever I would try to read as a child, as soon as we got into chapter books, I couldn't get through a paragraph. I could get through the first couple of lines and then I'd be lost. And I also felt sick to my stomach. I'd get a headache. I felt nauseous. It was really an awful experience for me to try and read.
I bet.
Prior to that, before I ever had to look at paragraphs when I was much younger child, I could read no problem. And I was one of the best readers in the class. So what happened when I got further up into the higher grades, nobody at that point realized that the reason why I was struggling to read all of a sudden was because my eyes couldn't track properly and they couldn't focus together properly. So I just went through school struggling with reading. And in university, well, I was pretty good at avoiding reading for my school career. I got pretty good at it. And until I got to university. So once I got to Western, I either had to find a way to get through reading all those textbooks or else I wasn't going to do better than 60% average. That became very clear to me very quickly after my first midterm. So I had to find a way to suffer through the reading. And when I forced myself, literally had to force myself through the headaches, through the nausea. And when I did, I started seeing double and my vision would blur in and out. So that was an epiphany to me. Of all my life, I never knew why reading was a problem. But because I was taking my first year psych courses at that point, I had an inclination that was actually where I first learned about how the two eyes work together and how you see, how a person sees, if their eyes are aligned or if they're misaligned. I was able to tell myself when I started seeing double that I wasn't having my eyes focusing together on the page, and I could actually, based on where I was seeing the image, I could tell if I saw this image I was seeing over here and the other image from the other eye I'm seeing over on that side. So therefore, my eyes are apart. They're not focusing together on point. They're apart from each other, separated. The light bulb went off like, oh my God, how is this possible? I have a vision problem. I've never, up until that point, never had blurry vision. You know, there was never anything that I couldn't quote unquote see. I'd always had thought to be perfect vision. So it was just a real awakening for me. And I became more and more keenly interested in wow, you know, this is fascinating. And look at what's going on and look at what's happening with how this works. And I was learning all about it more and more and more in all my courses about the physiology of the senses. And I decided at that point that I was going to switch all my previous plans of wanting to apply into dentistry and go into optometry instead and pursue a solution to that. That's how I ended up getting interested.
That's amazing. And that, I mean, it sounds like you figured that all out by yourself.
Yeah, it was quite a revelation. I remember sitting there at my desk in my bedroom studying and having that experience of seeing the page split apart into two and two, you know, two sets of words and two sets of pages and then going, oh, wow, what the heck? Like, this is vision. Now, at this point, I knew it was vision. Up until then, I only had nausea and I figured I just didn't have a strong enough stomach for reading, so I never linked it to vision until I actually saw double.
So what did you have to do at that point? Did you seek help of some kind?
No, I was just more curious and more interested in, you know, playing around with it myself. And I would close an eye, I would cover an eye, I would do that so that I would only see one. And I did eventually go and see an optometrist for an eye exam, like just a general eye exam, nothing too detailed or specific, and I didn't get into all the details. But yeah, I didn't really seek help. The internet didn't exist back then. It wasn't like I could just jump on Google and say, "Hi, Dr. Google, what is that? You know, what's double vision and where do I go and who do I see?" And so it was a very different world in that regard as far as, you know, learning and finding out information. So basically I just pursued with my, I'm going to say colleagues that I was working with in the vision research departments and working with some of the PhD students in there as well. And really, you know, playing around with what my eyes were doing. But other than that, that was as far as I went.
Did you see changes in your ability to read as you played around with these things, or did it take some time?
It definitely that wasn't enough. That wasn't enough to do anything helpful to solve my issues. Even when I went to optometry school, so this was another interesting experience when I attended Waterloo School of Optometry. At that point in time, there wasn't much instruction on the treatment of binocular vision coordination problems. And we had a little bit, but very little practical training on somebody does have a binocular vision dysfunction. I mean, we learned about how to diagnose them, but we didn't get very much practical training on, okay, now what do you do about it? How can we help? So we got by maybe two or three different exercises very briefly introduced to us that, you know, you can have them do these couple of little things, but nothing really that enough, not in depth enough to do anything with it. So it was very disheartening to me in the sense that I still didn't have the answers that I needed after optometry school from Waterloo to help myself at that point. Been in practice for 10 years, still, you know, not only searching to still solve my own binocular vision issues at that point, but now I'd been seeing more and more people coming into my practice. Usually the ones I was seeing at that point were kids who'd been sent in from the schools with similar complaints. You know, we just want to rule out vision as a potential cause for why this kid's not doing well in school. And time after time after time, it was the same story as myself. My vision's 20/20. It's, you know, there's no nearsighted, no farsighted. There's nothing, no glasses I can give you that's going to help. There's no lazy eye per se, if you will. There's no, you know, it's not turning or it's not blind in one eye. None of those things were, there's nothing we were able to diagnose as to, you know, vision wise, why this kid would be having trouble with reading based on what we do and what we learn to do in a general eye exam, you know, time after time. And this happens not just, you know, not just for me as a general practitioner, but most optometrists when doing a general exam, those are the various different tests that we're going to run. And someone with a binocular vision issue can pass those. 9 times out of 10, they'll be able to pass them and still be having tremendous problems reading and such. So I just kept feeling like I was, you know, banging my head against the wall. And why is this kid complaining that reading makes them feel nauseous? And I don't have an answer for them other than it makes me feel nauseous too. And I still don't have an answer. It did come to my attention. There were more and more schools and more students going down and training in the U.S. that some of the universities in the U.S. were teaching rehabilitative vision therapy, which was remarkable. And a lot of these, as these Canadian students, a lot of them would go down there and train and then come back. And vision therapy was starting to emerge more and more, for this reason becoming more popular in Canada. And that's something that really started to mushroom. At that point, I'd been in practice for 10 years. I found the College of Optometrists and Vision Development in the U.S. And then I went down and did my, it's back and forth. I was going back and forth and doing courses in the U.S. for my fellowship to become board certified in vision therapy. And it was through that is when I started doing vision therapy on myself. That is when I finally was able to read.
I'm sitting here with like my mouth agape, like, oh my gosh. First of all, well, there's consistency. Yeah. Like, all the things you had to deal with to get all those degrees and then practice and then searching and then finally figuring it out and going like, okay, finally. I don't get nauseous when I read.
Finally. Oh, it's so great. It's just so fantastic. And, you know, all these years growing up and as a kid, and even as, you know, as a university student, scratching my head, going, trying to read something and thinking to myself, how does anybody do this? It's quite remarkable. But when your eyes haven't learned how to team and your eyes haven't learned how to work properly, then there's, you know, that's not something that you can consciously teach yourself. That comes through the learning that's done in vision therapy. So, and you know, that can help it happen for any reason, whether it be developmental or due to a head injury. So if you have a head injury or some kind of insult to the brain, then same thing. It knocks out all those coordination centers for the two eyes to work together properly and coordinate the eye movements that you need to do for reading and everything else.
So from my own understanding of the human brain, and body, actually, from the context of movement and development, like a physio would have, right? Yeah. I know that vision plays a huge role in how we organize our body's movements, down to posture, gesture, communication. How we approach a given movement task, this might be actually repeating myself, is hugely related to our vision. Yep. So in my clinical treatment room, I can find that vision can be the reason that a person sometimes moves in a way that gives them pain or creates a movement dysfunction. And sometimes I can use a patient's visual system to help augment an exercise program or treatment protocol.
So cool, eh?
Yeah, it's really cool. It's very fun. Can you tell us, some of the kinds of concerns a patient might have that comes to the neurovision therapy clinics, and then the ways that you're not a typical optometrist?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So most of the patients who come to see us, the majority of our clinic practice, at least anywhere between 50 to 70% of our patients are either concussion or traumatic brain injury or head injury. And the other ones are kids with learning dysfunctions or disabilities, vision related learning stuff, and or lazy eyes. And so the large majority of the people we're working with come with symptoms of head injury. And usually when they're coming to see us, it's because their symptoms haven't gone away. And like you said, they've been doing the initial recommended protocol of whatever it be, a couple of months, a month in the dark, and they've been working away and maybe doing some physio, maybe not. And they're still wondering why, you know, they're running into barriers to treatment and or just not, these symptoms aren't going away like they should be or haven't fully resolved. So the symptoms being often headache still that's kicking around, or they might still be getting double vision or not, or blurring in and out of vision. And a lot of them are still having dizziness or nausea, and a lot of them are still having balance problems. Well, those tend to be the big, that along with light sensitivity, but those tend to be the main functional issues that they're struggling with. Reading is hugely impacted by all of those dizzy, nausea, eye pain, headache, and they just find that reading ability is typically reduced to anywhere maybe they can do up to a half an hour of reading. Oftentimes, a lot of people that I'm seeing can read for 5 or 10 minutes, and then they're in so much pain they just can't do it anymore, or their eyes go so out of focus they just can't see it anymore. So The people that we're seeing that have head injury and concussion are unable to work for the most of them. Their work is definitely impaired, or they're down to halftime because they don't have the stamina and they're too fatigued. Even if they can read for even a couple of hours, then it's exhausting to try and see, because their vision system's taking up so much energy out of their brain. All that is so inefficient that it's just burning up so much energy.
So it sounds like you've created a series of clinics that provide services to people suffering from vision system related dysfunctions. And I guess included in this population are folks with concussions.
Yes.
Why don't we start with some kind of fundamental stuff here so we can all understand what it is and how optometrists can help? So could you, like, what is a concussion really? We hear it all the time. What is it?
Right. So it's that coup contre coup effect where the brain, it basically it's floating inside the skull, and it gets, whether this is the interesting thing, and you'd alluded to this too, about whether helmets are going to help a concussion or not. And it doesn't matter if there's an actual impact to the head or not, because you can get a whiplash, or even just if you're playing sports and you get a really hard body shot, but it rocks your head in such a way that it causes your brain to shift inside the skull, and the skull now has this, it bangs itself against the inside of the skull on one side, and then back again, it rocks back and hits the back on, of the skull on the other side. So that's where I think that was a really brilliant point that you brought out about really how are helmets going to help in that particular type of a concussive injury. So yeah, that's basically when that brain, if you can imagine, the way that I like to explain it and the way I like to think about it is you've got this big giant brain, and it's basically sitting on the brainstem, and the brainstem is just this like a stalk that comes in to the skull, and it's like a fulcrum. So you've got this great big brain. It's like a bobblehead. And it's as it's rocking back and forth in the concussion during the injury, all the tiny little nerve fibers, those, millions and billions of nerve connections, those nerves get stretched. Those connections, those synapses, they also become more pulled apart, and the synaptic gaps. And it also creates, so you get these shearing forces on the little nerve fibers, and you get chemical changes in the brain and nerve fibers all surrounding those signaling areas until they can restore their proper biochemistry, and the synaptic membranes can restore. They just aren't signaling properly.
Is it changes in brain chemistry that might create things like memory disruption or personality changes? I understand that those are the kinds of things that can happen in a concussion. Like, what happens and how?
So the best way I can explain, I don't know if other people would have different explanations, and they're researching all the time different possible explanations. So any time, like whether it be memory, because memory is going to happen in so many different parts and areas of the brain. There's so many different types of memory and so many different areas of the brain that are implemented in different types of memory. And so it wouldn't really, any part of the brain, it wouldn't necessarily be specific to memory, but it could be any part of the brain that got the nerve fibers stretched or sheared, little nerve fibers that got damaged. It would then, if it happened to be in that area of the brain that was responsible for a certain kind of memory, or like oftentimes, like a lot of the things that we see based on that midbrain region, a lot of the filtering, being able to filter out light, filter out sound. So noise, sound sensitivities and noises are too loud. And it all has to do with relatively what particular areas in the brain are getting the majority of the shearing and stretching damage.
So that's why it can be so varied how people mm-hmm. experience their concussions.
Correct. Right. And the other thing with a concussion too is even depending on the angle of the hit. So if you got hit from the side, if you got hit from front to back or from corner to corner, and to have that shearing force going along a slightly different path throughout the brain. But usually that part of that midbrain region is where that, if you will, where that stalk connects, where the brainstem connects to the cortex. Mm-hmm. Usually that area is going to be impacted, even if other areas, there'll be more variability depending on what direction of the hit. But usually that section is going to be involved in most people. So there'll usually be some commonalities with people who've had a concussion, but then that's where you'll also get the variabilities.
Got it. And so it creates a problem of connection.
Mm-hmm. And signaling.
And signaling. So communication.
I have a question that's kind of out of left field, but I as you're talking here about this connection stuff, I realize I have a number of people that I work with in my practice who have hypermobility syndromes of various kinds. And I wonder if that might be a risk factor in terms of getting a concussion. Some of those fibers are more easily disturbed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and very interesting point. And quite possibly, I think, I don't know, I don't have an answer for that. I know that certain things that do affect, like neck strength, for one, just in general, would have an impact on how severe a concussion is and how quick the recovery is or not. The other thing that I found remarkable, and I don't really know if just some people's brains have more cushioning than others, if somebody's ever done if there are studies out there, I don't know, I haven't seen them. But if it makes sense to me that, for example, you can have somebody, and even just the other thing too, is how solid are your connections and how efficient are your neural connections? Or are you already compensating for something? Are your neural connections, did they not fully form in development as optimally initially, but you've been able to manage and compensate? I think that's going to be a factor as well as to, are you going to sustain the effects, like the prolonged effects or post-concussion syndrome or post-concussive or post-trauma vision syndrome? And the other thing that, why I tend to think that is I've seen people in my practice where notoriously, we know people can just sustain massive hit after massive hit, and just like you think, how is it possible that you don't have a concussion? And I've even thought that myself. I've had some pretty bad falls and head injuries, and thought to myself, oh, I must have a concussion. How can I not have a concussion after that? And then I don't seem to have any effects or after effects, and I'm thinking, wow, I must have a really hard head, but. But then you can also feel the effects of that years and years and years down the road. So 10 years, 20 years down the road can like trigger some post-concussion syndrome. And I've experienced that myself. But the one thing that the flip side of that is the person who was sitting on a park bench that happened to be a little bit teetery, and someone comes down and sits beside them and just jars the bench, and they bump. Person has a slight little bump up and down, and they come into my office with almost the worst post-concussive syndrome symptoms I've ever seen.
Wow.
Standpoint. And all of their doctors have been telling them there's no way you can possibly have a concussion from that. Yeah. She has all of the symptoms. So yeah, it's a very interesting as to what is going on that makes some people more susceptible and other people's not. And I think that there's a variety of reasons. There's got to be a multitude of different reasons as to why some people are more resilient to not feeling the effects of it, whereas other people it takes almost nothing.
What are the symptoms of a concussion? How do we know somebody's had one?
So yeah, largely one of the things. So headaches certainly. The sensitivity to light is a big one. Sensitivity to sound is another big one. Dizziness and nausea, visual fatigue, and just general fatigue. Those are some of the big ones. Balance, of course, can be a predominant one, but not necessarily. A lot of people who have concussion not have balance issues. The other one that's hit and miss with people is whether they have double vision or not. And most of them, almost all of them, will have problems afterwards with either with reading of some sort. They'll have some issues with not being able to read very long or at all. And memory, being able to understand things, being able to multitask. So being able to be in that meeting where you have to be looking at your computer and writing stuff down and taking notes while you're talking to a client and looking at filling out paperwork. So those sort of multitasking cognitive demands.
Okay. Well, you talked earlier about post-concussion syndrome. And I've heard that this, you know, if someone's had a concussion and then they get another one and maybe a third one, that it gets more detrimental all the time. Why is that?
So what's interesting is there also seems to be a timeline as to how close those concussions happen in sequence. So if somebody has a concussion, it takes approximately, these are just the averages, but approximately a month, roughly, for those connections, those nerve fibers, to rebuild their membranes and connections. So if somebody has a concussion, has another hit within that window, before those fibers have a chance to rebuild and recover, the effects will last for, after that's in second concussion, will last for much, much longer, usually 3 to 6 month mark. And if, again, during that period of time, things are starting to heal, same way with the nerve fiber regeneration, then if you have another hit in that time frame, then we know that the recovery period can be indefinite. So, wow. Yeah. And then it depends on what you're doing to tap into the neuroplasticity to rebuild that, right? And then there become other barriers to treatment, such as, you know, had they sustained any other physical injuries in the course of the accident when they sustained the concussion, or do they have any physical ailments that would prevent them from being able to do the treatments to tap into the neuroplasticity to rebuild those connections? So there become a multitude of factors as to, at that point, how well or how easy it's going to be for somebody to recover.
So we're going to get more into how to treat it. Mm-hmm. But first, I want to do a brief true-false round. Are you game?
Yeah.
So we say, if you get to a point and you're like, oh, I need to expand on that, then just do that. Dive in. All right. So somebody takes a hit and we suspect a concussion. True or false? We should wake them up each hour all night long that first night.
You know what? I don't actually know what the right answer is. There is a right answer.
For concussion, it's false. If you suspect a traumatic brain injury, i.e. a bleed, absolutely wake them up.
Right.
But if you don't suspect that, but you're like, that personality is really weird, or you know, they seem to be really sensitive to light, you're going to let them sleep, because sleep is one of the most restorative things. That's what I understand. Mm-hmm. True or false, we should take all visual stimuli away from someone who has a concussion. Dark room, no screens.
Well, no screens. Potentially that aspect, screens, are not a bad idea.
Hmm.
Right? Dark room, not necessary. Mm-hmm. But you will want to respect their level of light sensitivity. So they can still be visually stimulated in a normal environment, given they will determine what their level of light sensitivity is.
Right. So act in accordance with their symptoms.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, there are very few people that are so light sensitive that they need to just be in a blackout room for whatever, a week, a month. But they may want to wear sunglasses around inside their house, and they may Some people, you know, if they haven't recovered that aspect, it can be easily after a couple of years, and they're still wanting to wear their sunglasses inside the house, but they're still able to get around.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. The key there is respect their level of symptoms. Everybody's got a different level of symptoms. Screens are very aggravating if they have a vision issue after a concussion, which most likely people will, at least even temporarily, being that one of the remove from play tests that's used is a saccadic eye movement test. So actually the ability to make an eye movement, a certain type of eye movement from one location to another, is that reliable of a measure of someone having had a concussion?
So I think what you're saying is that is a very reliable mm-hmm. way to tell if someone's had a concussion, and it's saccadic mm-hmm. eye movement. Can you describe that?
Yep. So the particular test that's used most often or commonly is called the King-Divick, and it's where a person has to read rows of numbers. And so the saccade is the eye movement that's required to move the eyes from one number on the page over to the next number, to the next number, and so forth, down all the numbers in the line.
Got it.
That's where they're able to tell if that is impaired, their ability to do that, read those numbers in the proper order, in the proper, within a certain time frame. So either if they're doing it too slowly or inaccurately, then that's an indication the saccadic eye movement system is working, and that's indicative of concussion and remove from play.
True, false. After concussion, it is wise to have a period of rest, both physical and cognitive.
Yeah, rest is definitely hugely restorative. And one of the things that I see in my practice, in my clinic, is the people who are able to give themselves the rest that they need, and that amount of rest that they need will be proportionate to their degree of recovery. So as they're recovering, they can gradually take on more. As they continue to recover, they still can take on more, but they still need to respect the amount of rest, and they may need to go home and have a nap after work, or if they're at that point of recovery, or whatever the case may be. They need to respect that in order to keep themselves healing and getting to the end of eventually being recovered. And if they don't, the people that I see in my practice who don't aren't either in a position where they can either take the time off work that they need to rest and recover, or if their life is too busy and too hectic, they can't step back to give themselves times off in the evening to have that nap and rest, they are the ones that notoriously take a way longer to recover. It does not help them get better any faster when they're overtaxed and just fatiguing their system.
You talked a little bit about some of the symptoms that are pretty clear indicators that a concussion is present. Is that how an optometrist becomes involved in treating concussions?
So the interesting thing is a general optometrist wouldn't be in a position, is they're not set up to do the rehabilitative vision therapy that's involved with treating a concussion.
Right.
And what they would be initially just looking for is, do they still see 20/20 per se, or, you know, is their vision, visual acuity, their level of eyesight, has that been affected? And almost always it's not. I'm not going to say never, because sometimes it can be, right, very, very rarely, but almost always the eyesight is not affected and the vision is still 20/20. And the next thing that they'll check is, has the prescription changed in their glasses, or if they didn't need glasses, do they now? And the answer to that is, if they had nearsighted, farsighted, astigmatism, any of those typical reasons why someone would wear a pair of glasses, almost always that never changes. That doesn't change after a concussion either. And then the next thing the optometrist is going to check for is, was there any structural damage to the eyeball itself? And is the inside of the eye still healthy? Are the nerves all intact inside the eye? Has there been any swelling potentially, or bleeding, or, you know, broken blood vessels in the eye, anything like that, that we'd need to check and make sure that everything's intact health-wise and the retina is still intact. So the next thing the optometrist will check is, okay, now are the eyes coordinating together as a team? Are the two eyes moving back and forth the way they're supposed to? Are they converging, coming in to look close up the way they're supposed to? And when they find that those areas have been affected, then that's when they would refer out to somebody who does vision therapy. So an optometrist such as myself, or a neurodevelopmental rehabilitative optometrist. And we dive in a whole lot deeper and look at all the various ways that the vision channels coordinate with the body. So we're looking at, and as you had alluded to, about how the connection between the vision and the body. So we look at the whole purpose of vision is to direct movement, is to derive meaning, so to understand and get meaning out of your environment, but then also to direct an action. And your vision is what's responsible for creating the equations, if you will. So the vision looks at space, whatever's in the space or environment. It calculates how far away it is, exactly where it is, and it sends that equation to your muscles so that your muscles can accurately interact with it or reach out and pick up your coffee cup. So it's vision systems constantly creating equations for your muscles to solve. And there's a pathway that goes from your vision, from your eyes, through your brain, and then directly down through your superior tectum and down your spinal cord. And that particular pathway of your vision from your optic nerve, from your eyes for your vision, does not make pictures. That's not the part of your vision system that creates eyesight. So we dig more deeply into that pathway, as well as all the different eye movement functional skills and readjustment and refocusing skills.
And these are the things that you're doing at Vision Therapy?
That's right.
Do you use computer-generated treatment interfaces and, you know, those things that are a little bit like a computer game? Or is it kind of sometimes reading and comprehension?
Yeah. So most of what we do, and especially for somebody with a concussion, the last thing that I'm going to do initially is put them in front of a computer screen.
Oh, right.
Guys. And although we do use computer-generated therapy, especially later on in therapy, and when we need to rehabilitate somebody who's had a concussion, once we get their visual skills up to a certain level, then they're able to handle all the different things that come along with a computer screen. And then we need to introduce the computer screen, and they need to rehabilitate to that because they've got to get back to doing 7 hours a day at their job on a computer screen. And we do have computer neurovisual trainer is an awesome program that we're using now. It's one of the new ones. And it is something that we can give our patients to do at home on their own computers. And we also have ones that big screen things such as Sanavision integrators that we use in the office for a variety of visual training techniques. But those are very, very small portions. Like that's maybe 10% of our vision therapy training program.
What does it look like?
So most of it is it's a lot of in free space. It's reintegrating your peripheral vision with your center vision. And that's one of the things that tends to be almost always affected in a concussion as well. People tend to, after a head injury, shut down their peripheral vision. And not to the sense that if you went in to have a test to see if you were blind spots in your peripheral vision, or for example, you know, somebody after a stroke, potentially they completely lose their blind in their peripheral vision to one side, potentially. So it's not like that kind of a thing after a concussion where you've actually physically lost your peripheral vision. But what they do is they functionally suppress it. So it's not that it can't work. It's just that the brain shuts it, actively shuts it off.
Right.
And then they just become very centrally focused using their central focusing system. So that they have a lot of peripheral vision symptoms, such as the scrolling on a computer screen can cause them dizziness or nausea or just eye strain, pain, that kind of stuff. Or another peripheral vision symptom is they might actually see things. If you're sitting still in a room, for example, the things that are around you, all around in the room, may look like they're moving, but they're not, and you know they're still, but they appear to be moving. And or the peripheral vision that can just be more just distorted. So there's a whole variety of different things that can happen in the peripheral vision after a head injury, and we work there a lot. We spend a lot of time reintegrating that.
How long does it take to make progress with this kind of work?
So again, depends on the person, on their resiliency, how severe their injury was. And the fastest we've ever had somebody recover from all the visual effects, post effects, has been 6 months. So it is possible to go through our 6 month vision training program and be done and have everything back to normal. And that tends to have been a lot of our teenagers who have been in that category where they're done in 6 months. And there have been some that surprised me, some that have had a plethora of concussions. So we worked with several teenagers who've had, you know, 5 to 7 or 9 concussions. And by the time, you know, they managed to have, you know, concussion number 8, they still recovered, and then concussion number 9, and that was it. They couldn't function anymore. And, you know, they dropped either out of school or had to drop down to one course or whatever the case may be. And at that point, when they come to see me and I'm thinking, this is now very severe, and plus the history of so many concussions, you know, is this going to take years for them to recover? And then they surprise me and they're done in 6 months as well. Sometimes it's hard to predict how long, but I can say that it's possible to finish in 6 months. A lot of people, you know, some adults, motor vehicle accidents, and a whole host of, again, other factors, whether it be a lot of the stuff that we do requires whole body movement. And if they have other injuries that prevent that, then that can make things take longer. Also, depression and anxiety are factors after an accident like that can impact their recovery time. So we can have people in vision therapy for a couple of years. You know, it's not uncommon to going on between 2 and 3 years. The other problem that we see in recovering from a concussion is repeat concussions while they're in therapy. So, yeah, this actually happened to one of my first concussion patients. He's now one of my vision therapists, and he went through vision therapy. He was in vision therapy for, well, the initial concussion that he had, and I'll preface this with, he had pre-existing vision issues, a lazy eye and eye convergence issues prior to having that first concussion. So we were actually already working with him prior to his first concussion for the convergence issues and computer vision syndrome. And then he happened to have a concussion. So then we started working on that. He was off work because of it. And we got him, he was just about ready to go back to work. He went back to work after a year, and then he had a couple of weeks, was in a car accident, had another concussion. Then he was in vision therapy with us again. And then within that time, he had again another concussion, which set him back. So it's like starting from scratch. We got him almost done. Within that time, he had another concussion, set him back again. He ended up being in vision therapy with us for probably about 4 years. You just have to keep going back and letting the system recover.
So I'm still struggling to understand what vision therapy consists of. Like, can you give us an example of a whole body movement exercise? Are they doing it at home? Do they have to go to a clinic?
So they do need to work with a vision therapist, either weekly or monthly. At our clinic, some people it's biweekly, but for the most part, it's either most effective if they're on a weekly program or a monthly, where we've taught them how to do the exercises. Now, there are programs that we do now virtually because of COVID, where now we send people the equipment that they need to use at home. And so the need for them to come into the clinic to work with our equipment that's in the office with the vision therapist in person is largely diminished. Although there are some people that are still in that situation where we need them to work in person with the therapist, or we need them to do certain things, techniques that we only have, that equipment isn't something we can ship to their house and they can do at home. So the programs, even when they're designed to work with a vision therapist once a week, they still are practicing the exercises at home themselves. So there may be certain techniques that they will be only able to do once a week in the office with a therapist, which is fine. Then they'll also have 4 or 5 activities that they can do at home that they will practice. That takes them maybe on average 20 minutes. And those exercises can involve a variety of different things. We want to target several different areas. We want to be able to target how their eyes are moving. So we do different eye movement exercises. We also want to target eye focusing exercises where their eyes are having to zoom in and out. So each eye inside, there's like an auto zoom, if you will, like on a camera. And the brain's job is to zoom this focusing system in and out, various from far to close, whatever distance it is that you need to look at. And quite often that system gets knocked out in a concussion as well. So we need to help them relearn how to do that. So we rebuild that system. And that requires a lot of lens work. So we'll have them working with a whole host of variety of different types of focusing lenses to relearn how to adjust, readjust their focusing system. And another type of, when we start talking about like the whole body movements, a lot of it comes down to readjusting knowing where your body is in space. So that's one of the first aspects, if you will, or first components of vision. If we break vision down into four different components, it's the first is, where am I? So your vision system has to have that frame of reference to know, first of all, where you are in space. And we need to recalibrate your whole vision with your body to know that your visual center is lining up with your body center. So we'll do a lot of different, for example, walking rail activities on different types of slanted walking rails, because we want to trigger different reflexes. There's different reflexes that are involved in the nervous system and vision development and other sensory motor and neurodevelopment in general. And we want to also have them be able to recalibrate where their visual world is spatially in reference to their body. So we use also different types of lenses, special types of lenses that are prisms, and we orient them in certain directions called yoke prism. It just happens to be a certain type of orientation that shifts the visual space or rotates the visual space. And then they have to recalibrate their vision system to be able to adjust. And we can also have them down literally on the ground and doing body awareness, because we have to be, in order for somebody to reintegrate using two eyes together, they need to be able to reintegrate using right and left sides of their brain together. So we need to rebuild that right left brain communication. So there can be whole body movements. They are down, moving around on the ground, doing either triggering reflexes or generating that movement of using right brain and left brain together.
No, it's fascinating. I had no idea. That's very, very cool. Okay. So
I think so.
We could go on at length, and it's so many things to think about and talk about in terms of concussion, like the return to play and return to learn protocols, and how does everybody communicate with everybody else about the needs of that concussed student, for instance, or employee. And you know, dear listeners, if you are concussed or you know someone that is, like, reach out to your professionals, because there's more and more research and there are more and more practitioners who can help you navigate that system. I do want to ask you, or at least touch on, so the research about tau proteins and the dangers of concussions that's been sort of thrust into the limelight in the last 5 years or so. I think this was, or even 10 years now. Notably, it was a study of the NFL football players that had died with mental illness issues around dementia that they felt was related to the numbers of concussions those players had taken. And then, which makes it be like, well, why would I ever want to be involved in a sport that might give me a concussion? When we dig deeper, there have been other follow-up research to suggest that those particular proteins don't necessarily indicate a causal relationship. So other NFL players without any dementias also had these proteins in their brains. And we also know that there are dangers in a sedentary lifestyle. And those are not suggested, but proven fact, that if you avoid movement, that is deleterious to your body over time. The human body was meant to move, right? So with all of this stuff, and you more than anybody, or, you know, more than a lot of people would know how challenging concussion can be for people. What are your thoughts on contact sports?
Well, I feel like as long as everybody is making their own informed decision, they know what the risks are, they know what they're getting into. So nobody's going to be shocked at the end of the day if they have an injury and, you know, that they at least didn't catch them by surprise. So they knew what they were getting into. And here's what I feel about it after somebody has had a concussion. If they end up being in a situation where they've been repeatedly concussed and now it's debilitating them to the point that they can no longer attend school, or they're going to end up losing a year of school because they can't read, and they, you know, they've got to take time to rebuild that, then they really need to, at that point, reevaluate that that's no longer a good idea for them. And even if they get better, right? At that point, it's just not wise to put yourself back into that environment. So there can be people that go through contact sports and never have a concussion or never suffer any ill effects or prolonged effects. So one is, I just think the general awareness that people are going to make their own decisions, but be it an informed decision. Mm-hmm. And then also make sure that you're not resubjecting yourself to that if it turns out that you're susceptible, that your brain is more one of these people who are more susceptible, then reevaluate. That's not a good idea for you. You know, that's not going to do you any favors to go down that road in the long run. And the other thing is looking at what can protect you on the field or on the ice from having a concussion in the first place. And one of those things can very well be your vision. So and it comes down to peripheral vision. A lot of the kids that we're working with that are in minor hockey, a lot of them, well, all of the ones that I worked with, granted, I wasn't a random sample by any means, but they all had restricted peripheral vision. And on average, restricted to the point that it's around 30 to 40%, like it's functioning at 30 to 40% capacity. So you have a kid on the ice where their peripheral vision is only functioning at 30 to 40% capacity. How much of the ice do you think that kid is going to be seeing when they're out there? Do you think that kid's going to be seeing that person who's heading for them that may or may not be going to run into them or body check them? Not, you know, there's probably a 60% chance that they're not going to see that. So taking those preventative measures, making sure if your kid's in those kind of sports, get them in to see what capacity their peripheral visual function is, how well they're integrating their peripheral vision. And then at least you know that they're seeing the entire play, that they're able to access all that visual information. They're less likely to be susceptible to be in a situation where they're...
Oh, that's fascinating. So you could use a vision therapist for assessing risk. That's great.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And then kids oftentimes too, I actually did baseline concussion testing from the vision standpoint, the baseline visual skills that we test for post-concussion. And it was almost every single player that we tested, and we did, I don't know how many teams, like hundreds of players, and almost every single one of them had a near-far focus. That, remember I said that brain has like an auto zoom, like a camera?
Right. Yep. So
one of them had issues with that focusing system. And that's, again, one of the most common systems to be knocked out in a concussion. So that system's already compromised already before a concussion. It's going to be way more susceptible to be even worse and cause more ill effects after a concussion. So those are the things that we can build or restore prior to any injury, and you're going to be in a way better position to not be suffering post-trauma vision syndrome if you're already if your vision system and the visual functions already is in a stronger position before you had a hit.
You can concussion proof your brain.
I don't know that I'd go that I'd say that, but still have a concussion, but the post-concussion, like the post concussive syndrome, the post-trauma vision syndrome, those prolonged effects that can often end up sticking around and sustaining, those can be mitigated or minimized.
Okay. Well, Coralie, we're at the point in the podcast where we ask our trademark question. So in your opinion, mm-hmm. what is health?
Health is well-being. Health is knowing who you are, that you're taking everything into account physically, mentally, emotionally, and having all of those in harmony where you're taking care of yourself. And to me, it's a very holistic entity. It's, you need all of those pillars in place to have good health.
Beautiful.
We need to be collaborating.
Health as a collaborative project. I think I love that. We have really enjoyed speaking with you today about this important subject, and I learned things today that I'm going to use. So thank you for helping us understand the broader role that optometrists can play in supporting the health of our brains at all ages and stages. Thanks for being here and for shedding so much light on the topic.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So that's all for today's small conversation. We hope that you enjoyed it as much as we did. We will provide links to Dr. Coralie Mueller's website, neurovisiontherapy.com, in the show notes. We'll tell you how to find her on the socials, both Facebook and Instagram, at Neurovision Therapy. We'll also include some resources like the Return to Learn and Return to Play guidelines through the catonline.com website. And if you're interested in assistance at school for your concussed student athlete, I suggest you reach out to your school's counselors.
We'll be here next time.
And we will have the coffee.
If you liked what you heard, we encourage you to head on over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. Better yet, subscribe and leave a review. That really helps to make it easier for others to find us, to help broaden this small conversation.